This podcast features graphic details of real events taken from letters written by inmates convicted of murder. Listener discretion is advised.
I didn't witness how or when she was murdered. I didn't think anything on what was happening. I only thought, why is this happening at all?
These are the written words of Texas inmate number 161-3478, Stephanie Hohobo. They're taken from letters that she wrote to us in 2018. My name is Ned Parker, and Stephanie Hohobo is one of over 2,000 inmates that my colleague Zoe Hines and I have corresponded with in our work as documentary filmmakers. Tragically, in this role, we've learned of many well-meaning Good Samaritans who've paid for their generosity in the most appalling ways. And that's exactly what happened to the victim in this particular case. But Stephanie Hohobo's letters to us also raise many questions about trust, honesty, and taking responsibility for your actions.
This is Letters from a Killer, a Podimo podcast. Episode 2, The Good Samaritan Slaying.
It's a Sunday in August 2019. I'm at my brother-in-law's house in Brighton. The kids are playing outside and he's showing me how to view live tweets on the world map on his TV. I wanted to get a sense of the social media response to the first season of I Am a Killer, which had just started airing on Netflix a few days earlier. And I see a flood of live tweets about our films. Every 15 to 20 seconds, a ping appears on the map showing where the tweet was from. And they're everywhere. Brazil, Japan, France, Australia, all over the US. And I sit transfixed, fascinated, just a little overwhelmed. After 20 years of producing documentaries, this is audience feedback on a scale that I've just never experienced before. But in amongst all these tweets, there is a small but persistent theme emerging, and it's one that troubles me. People keep asking, why did you only make films about men? Before we hear from our letter writer for this episode, let's try and answer this significant question. Why didn't we have any female inmates appearing in the first season of our Netflix series, I Am a Killer? And why are there so few in our investigations overall?
It's a fair question, and one we get asked a lot. Ultimately, it comes down to the numbers. Women do kill, but men kill far more often. To the extent that when we were doing the first series of I'm a Killer, we were looking at around 2,800 men on death row. That's in comparison with just 52 women. I should point out that while our letter writer for this episode, Stephanie Hohobo, has been convicted of murder, she's not one of the 52 women on death row at the time of this recording. However, as documentary filmmakers, we both agree that the female perspective is incredibly important, regardless of the numbers. And if we're going to listen to the voices of murderers, then we should absolutely include female murderers in the people that we're speaking to.
So in this episode, we will be bringing you something of a rare insight. Our first female letter writer for the series, Stephanie Hohobo.
Hearing Mrs. Betty's name, I thought of a plan. If I could speak to her, one-on-one, and run down everything I was going through, she would help me.
In this podcast, we're going to be exploring themes of victimization and innocence, and asking what is it that leads someone to lash out at others who are trying to help them. We'll hear about Hohobo's feelings towards the victim, and we'll also hear about her involvement or lack of involvement in the murder.
But before we explore Hohobo's letters, let's hear the details of her case.
Letters from a Killer. Case file. The following details are taken from official press reports and court documents. October 2005, Harris County, Texas. 43-year-old Roosevelt Smith, along with 18-year-old Stephanie Hohobo and her boyfriend, Jimmy Huang Lee, entered the house of 77-year-old church worker, Betty Blair. Smith, who had moved from Louisiana and claimed to be a Hurricane Katrina evacuee, had been sharing an apartment with the couple, who also claimed to be Hurricane Rita evacuees. Betty Blair was known to them, as she'd been helping them get back on their feet after meeting them at the St. Pius V Catholic Church food pantry, where Blair was volunteering. The three entered Blair's house with the intention of robbing her. While there, however, Smith physically attacked Blair before strangling her with a telephone wire. Shortly after 6 p.m., Betty Blair's daughter found her mother's body bound and strangled. Her wedding ring, purse, computer, television, video equipment, and car were missing. And it was Betty Blair's vehicle, a 2004 Buick LeSabre, that would lead the police to her killer. General Motors fits some of its cars with OnStar, a vehicle tracking system. And Blair's family knew that the Buick was fitted with this particular tracking device. Smith, Hohobo, and Huang Lee did not. By 8 p.m. that evening, five deputy constables of Harris County apprehended Roosevelt Smith, Jimmy Huang Lee, and Stephanie Hohobo. The three were arrested without confrontation.
After Hurricane Katrina, there were many displaced people in numerous states across the southern U.S. But it also happens to be an area where there is a significant amount of social and economic deprivation. So it's probably unsurprising that some people might have masqueraded as evacuees from Hurricane Katrina or Hurricane Rita, if only to receive economic support or charitable support, which would otherwise not have been granted to them.
And perhaps diving into Hohobo's letters, we'll begin to see that even if she wasn't a victim of Hurricane Rita, as she claimed to be, she certainly had her own battles and she potentially was looking for help in some way. But one thing that really sticks out about this case from the earliest of points, without even knowing the personal details of this victim, you already know that the perpetrators are people who consider it acceptable to take advantage in the most extreme way possible of someone who is trying to show goodwill.
We should hear from Hohobo's letters. These extracts are read by a voice actor, but they are her words, as written to us from prison.
At 7 years old, my mother died, and my father left with no return. My mental state went into shock, which resulted in depression. I was molested by an older cousin. It became no better when I was taken to be raised by my grandmother. Between the ages of 10 and 14, I was molested by my younger cousins. My grandmother tended to my depression with little attention. Her solution was to shelter and close me from my siblings, to keep me in church and school. My dreams and aspirations became a self-taught lesson. I wanted to be a teacher and cheerleader. I loved learning and cheering people on to do better in school and church. The outlook I had from 10 to 14 years old revolved around lean on God. He would fix it all.
Hohobo then writes about how being reunited with her siblings continued to have a negative effect on her young life.
At 14 to 18 years old, I left my grandmother to reunite with my siblings. This is when I was introduced to bad influences. It started with smoking weed. The criminal activities I engaged in was stealing, which led to spending 2 days in juvenile. I ran with gang members, but didn't affiliate. They were more like boys I grew up with or came across but weren't around long. I picked up bad habits. Violence was all around due to spouses fighting, drugs, and reckless, careless individuals.
So there are two things about this first extract that really stand out to me. The first is that Hohobo has chosen to dive straight in with the abuse that she encountered in her early years. And it's telling in the sense that it's clearly important to her to prioritise these as her formative childhood experiences. Of course, we do need to look at that within the context of her now being a convicted offender. But from a letter point of view, what's interesting is that she's trying from the top to say she too has been a victim. The second thing that stands out to me is the way Hohobo writes about teaching, cheerleading, encouragement, support. From the case details, we know that Hohobo wasn't the murderer, but was a supporting cast member, if you like. She was there. She was present at the time of the killing. I do think those words and that reflection are very interesting.
She seems to paint herself in the letter as someone who loves influencing others, wanting to be a teacher, cheering people on to do well. But I also think that it feels like she's someone who could be very easily influenced, because you've got to remember that at the time of the crime, she is just a teenage girl. In the next section of her letter, she talks about her relationship with the victim, Betty Blair.
My relationship with the victim was short-term. I did errands with her. I met her other family members. She loved my son. She would suspect unhappiness in my relationship with Jimmy and offer to get me out of the relationship by staying at her house. I couldn't accept it. She was helping to get my GED. She made me feel like I could get my life back on track. She made me feel a genuine love.
So from this, we can reasonably understand that Hohobo didn't finish high school. For British listeners, a GED is basically a diploma for people who didn't graduate from school. It's a series of tests that determine if the taker is at a high school level. But what's important here is that she's clearly being helped with this by the victim, by Betty Blair.
Here we have Hohobo adding a little characterisation to this lady. And for me, it's really chilling because obviously she was party to this woman's death.
And it's not often that you get an insight into the victim from the killer themselves, whether they knew them or not. And if they did know them, quite often there's an animosity in that relationship, which is why the crime took place. But here, what Hohobo is saying is that this is a woman who had her stay at her house, who loved her son, who was helping her with her education. To me, it feels that she's describing a close, intimate relationship. And I think that the way that she writes about Betty as a person is really interesting as well.
She writes about how she confided in Betty about really personal things, her crumbling relationship, putting her son in care. You just don't typically hear murderers talk about their victims like this. As you heard in our case file, Stephanie Hohobo's partner at the time of the murder of Betty Blair was a man called Jimmy Huang Lee. She claimed to have fled Hurricane Rita with him and their baby, and she writes about her relationship with Jimmy in the moments leading up to the murder.
The morning before the murder took place, my second oldest sister gave me a call, telling me she was on her way to visit my son and I. Upon her arrival, she noticed many bruises on my face and arms due to a previous night when Jimmy and I fought. I mentioned to my sister how I wanted out of the lifestyle and abusive relationship I was in. She wanted to take me with her. Jimmy refused to hand over my son. When she left, I was left feeling devastated, full of rage, and just wanted to get away back to Beaumont with my sister.
Stephanie Hohobo has now introduced the idea that she was in an abusive relationship with her accomplice and partner, Jimmy Huang Lee. She's unhappy and wanting to run away. Hohobo continues to write about the morning before the murder and explains that the idea for killing Miss Betty came from her other accomplice, the man who claimed to be a Hurricane Katrina evacuee, Roosevelt Smith.
Roosevelt mentioned out of the blue about killing Mrs. Betty. The thought to feed into his nonsense wasn't appealing. Hearing Mrs. Betty's name, I thought of a plan. If I could speak to her one-on-one and run down everything I was going through, she would help me. I thought the only way to get out of the house was to go along with what Roosevelt was talking about. We walked to her house. I wasn't able to find alone time with her. One minute, her and I were looking at photos on her wall, and the next minute, she's hit across the head. I didn't witness how or when she was murdered. I didn't think anything on what was happening. I only thought, why is this happening at all?
We've obviously read a lot of accounts of murders that have taken place, but this is a really upsetting one. This is a 77-year-old lady who clearly felt a connection with Stephanie Hohobo, to the extent that she trusted her enough to support her. But then the plan's made to rob Betty Blair, and they're not going to rob her while she's out, which is another point I don't fully understand. If they were close to her, surely they could have access to her house when she wasn't there. They could have avoided the violence. There was no reason to have to do it when Betty Blair was physically there. And the robbery did escalate to violence. And I assume in some way to ensure that she couldn't testify against them or identify them, Roosevelt Smith apparently then suggests killing Betty Blair.
Hohobo begins talking about the fact that this was Roosevelt's plan. And then within a sentence, she switches and she says, "I thought of a plan. I could speak to her one-on-one." And then she switches back as if she's surprised that Roosevelt hits Betty over the head.
It feels like she's trying to distance herself from that, saying that that's not something that she was comfortable with. But then she's also saying that she's somehow involved in this plan of distracting Betty Blair. And maybe it's just a case of her not expressing it well enough in her letters. Maybe Hohobo is trying to say that she was coming up with an alternative plan where she could distract Betty Blair so the other two could carry out the robbery in the house and she didn't expect them to attack her. Maybe that is what she's doing, but it's not clear. But what is clear is that, for me, Stephanie Hohobo didn't do everything in her power to stop the burglary taking place. And she certainly didn't do everything in her power to move Betty Blair to a place of safety.
There's definitely something very poignant and sad and intimate about the sentence where she describes looking at photos on the wall with Betty. We presume that those are family photos or personal photos, and you can really take yourself there. You can imagine that scene.
One minute her and I were looking at photos on her wall, and the next minute she's hit across the head.
And then there's this strange switch between painting enough detail for you to be able to visualise the scene that she's describing, and then suddenly not including any further details at all. It's like she just shuts it off. Okay, let's move on from the crime itself to what Hohobo talks about next, which is her life after the crime, her reflections on being arrested, and how she coped with life in prison.
Getting arrested, I felt an escape from the lifestyle and relationship I was in. I felt like I was to be released due to Roosevelt being arrested for committing the assault and murder. And given Jimmy was running on probation, he would be serving time for violation.
Hohobo then goes on to write about her experiences in prison.
My first days in county, I literally lost my mind. I had to see the chaplain and psych for 4.5 years. The first few days in prison, my feelings and thoughts ran high and low. It was difficult for me to withstand the concept of signing to life, and that therefore my actions had consequences.
She's asking for our sympathy at this stage by saying, "I lost my mind in prison. Getting arrested felt like an escape from my abusive relationship." And there's real tragedy there. But how does she expect us to feel sympathetic towards her when we've just read a passage where she hasn't accepted any moral or ethical responsibility for the death of this woman that she's characterised as a saint? It's a very strange attempt to try and get the reader back on side.
You can have sympathy, you can have empathy for someone who's committed a crime, even someone who's committed a violent crime, if you can see that they are truly sorry for it, or that they maybe got wrapped up in the circumstances which led to that. But the part that troubles me with Stephanie Hohobo is, what was it that she expected was actually going to happen?
I think it's worth a note at this point to say that we're not judging her ability to write a letter here. This is beyond the letter itself. It's about indicating a sense of what she's been involved with. And we've had far, far less literate writers who have managed to convey a sense of guilt, a sense of sorrow, a sense of wishing that they could turn the clock back in their letters to us.
Genuine remorse.
Yeah, and even those who fear expressing remorse because they somehow believe it will contradict their legal claim to a lesser charge, which we do see, There's a sense of genuineness that is just not present here. It's an absence.
This is clearly someone who's gone through great personal tribulations. It certainly feels that way reading from her letters, but we've also spoken to numerous murderers in other letters and in person. And for some of them, it just feels to me that it takes a long time to accept what they've done. But when they have that level of acceptance, when it eventually comes, that seems to be what it is that helps them. And I can't help but feel that maybe in this case, a hobo just isn't at that stage yet.
You're absolutely right. It's our responsibility as filmmakers, producers, researchers, as people, to remember the bigger picture when it comes to the perspective we're reading. She was young, she's a teenager, she's in stasis. How far does that go when it comes to the voice that we're reading in this letter? The final extract of her hobo's letters does take us to that place.
Looking back, I feel if I had known better, I could have and should have done better. By any means, if I would be put in a similar predicament today, I would handle the situation in a fashionable manner. I believe in the moment of the crime, between my serving time and today, all happens for a reason. There's a purpose for every individual. I matured and found my purpose in prison. I'm not the same person I was then. I'm wiser, better, and stronger as a whole individual. If I could give advice to the younger me, I'd say, whenever put in a reckless predicament, wisdom is the answer. Stay in school and away from boys. What happened lays heavy on my chest daily. I feel the victim has forgiven me, simply because of who she was, who she believed, and who she served.
That is quite a statement to write down in a letter. I feel the victim has forgiven me, because of who she was, who she believed, who she served. That Betty Blair has forgiven her because she's a Christian.
I've personally heard that phrase from 5 different inmates to my face, saying the victim would have forgiven them. And in 4 out of 5 of those instances, it was a deeply uncomfortable moment where it felt like the inmate was somehow trying to absolve themselves of the action in the same way that fate and talk of God might. It's really not for the victim to forgive Stephanie. This is her chance to take some responsibility. And when I'm reading these letters, I'm just willing her to acknowledge her part, however she perceives that, in the loss of Betty Blair's life.
Letters from a Killer. The verdict. The following details are taken from official news reports and court documents. In October 2007, Roosevelt Smith was sentenced to death. In November 2012, after a state-appointed psychologist deemed him mentally impaired, Smith's sentence was commuted to life without the possibility of parole. In January 2009, Jimmy Huang Lee was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. Then, in April 2010, after accepting a plea deal that was aimed at sentencing her partner, Huang Lee, Stephanie Hohobo was sentenced to life imprisonment. She will be eligible for parole in October 2035.
Hohobo took a plea deal, so she must have accepted some form of accountability. I'd be really interested to know what level of accountability that was, but based on what she's written, it would seem to me that it would be the absolute minimum possible. She's definitely pitched herself as an innocent bystander, a witness, essentially, and not even a witness to the murder itself.
And it's worth remembering that there were 3 people who were involved in this murder. 2 of them received sentences which mean that they will never walk free from prison ever again. And the 3rd one is Stephanie Hohobo. who will at some point likely be released. And I think for her, that has got to be an incentive to try and ensure that the release date is sooner rather than later, whether that's consciously or subconsciously. She will have that incentive not to say anything which is going to jeopardize that. And as such, I think it goes a long way in influencing the way in which she's written these letters to us. I don't think that she is able to fully accept her involvement in this crime either.
I'd like to think that we'll keep our eyes open around 2035 and see whether she's made parole.
In this episode, we've explored the letters of Stephanie Hobo. We've heard about her hopes and dreams from childhood.
I wanted to be a teacher and cheerleader. I loved learning and cheering people on to do better in school and church.
How she, in the same letter, has talked about the awful abuse that she says she suffered as a child.
My mental state went into shock, which resulted in depression.
We've been exploring the themes of victimization, how she chose to present herself as a victim from her early recollections right up until her experience after being convicted, and how disorientating being in prison was.
I feel if I had known better, I could have and should have done better.
And we've been talking about those thoughts in relation to her claim of innocence with regards to Betty Blair's death.
We heard about her hobo's feelings towards Betty Blair, her victim.
She made me feel like I could get my life back on track. She made me feel a genuine love.
Something which I struggle with here is trying to understand what it is that would lead someone to lash out or allow others to lash out at somebody who has done nothing but to try and support and help them.
Her hobo writes extensively about what a lovely person Betty was and how much she was trying to help her. But there's just so much more that I would hope somebody would write or at least reflect upon if they were that close with someone in the event of that person's death.
Next time on Letters from a Killer, I confess.
All I knew is I did not want to go to prison. He was full of mind games for this young dude. He wanted to do another job to have more dollars for meth. And that's the start of a new story.
Letters from a Killer was hosted by Zoe Hines and Ned Parker and is a Podimo podcast by Transistor Films. Support the show by sharing on social media and following the podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.